Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Is give our predictions for the Australian Open because we're not going to have any of this, oh yeah, I guessed that right. And we should say that it was a combination of time zones and illness and all sorts of bits that our preview pod never made it out. So I think it's only right we start with who we said, if you can remember, was going to win the Australian Open.
Well, I can remember. And I did a complete 180 on what I'd said in the pod before. And I'm pretty sure I went with Jannik Sinner.
Oh, did you? Did you? You didn't. Not having this.
No, if only, if only. I think I'd said before that he'll make a couple of finals this year.
Yep.
But won't break through. And, well, he was hands down the best player of the tournament, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But, well, you know, Medvedev obviously, you know, ran him very close. But, yeah, I mean, it was tremendous. No, I didn't pick Sinner. I picked Djokovic.
And
I did pick Sabalenka.
Oh, did you? Oh, yes, you did. Okay, I obviously got it wrong. I went Djokovic. I was convinced. And I went Rybakina. And I think Rybakina is going to be one of these players throughout the year that pulls me in and I go for her and then maybe lets me down. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Consistency. I just.
Well, she had a cracking start to 2024, didn't she?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I was feeling bad because I took her out of my top eight. I was thinking, well, that's a terrible call. But somebody's got to move. If you're putting new people in the top eight, some people have to come out. So you have to choose somebody.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So Rybakina, what did she, was it second round, third round? I can't remember what she made. It wasn't good anyway.
It wasn't where I needed her to get to. And I thought, well, I've still got Djokovic. That didn't happen. So we were both working on the Australian Open. I love the fact that we were in different time zones, but for the first part, we were working at the same time. I love that. So I know not so much for you because it was the middle of the night, but we could like chat away about all the matches. And the last few days, when you flipped time zone, I was quite lonely during the day because I couldn't send you messages.
I know, but it was not conducive for doing the pod because I was always on the day session and you were always on the night session. So
I know we had a shocker.
Basically, my 1 hour window was not helpful for you, and your 1 hour window, I was about ready to go for the day session. So we couldn't record.
Everyone, you've just finished working for the day, right?
I have. Yes. Did a couple of matches today. I'm working on Hua Hin this week. The right. 250 event in Thailand.
Okay, so I'm...
It's hot.
Excellent.
And it's sticky and sweaty. Have you ever seen this from Tatiana Maria? I don't think I've ever seen this.
What?
I mean, unless she's done it before or somebody else.
I'm intrigued.
I don't think I've ever seen this.
Right.
Sorry?
I'm intrigued. What is it? Well, I haven't seen it.
Sorry, Denise. I was rambling away myself. Yeah, get this. Sweatbands on her ankles.
Have we ever seen that? Is that to stop the sweat running down into the shoes and making the shoes...
Exactly. When you have shaved legs, there's nothing for the moisture to cling onto. It just streams down into your shoes, which is why I have no idea why lots of players have started shaving their legs who wouldn't ordinarily do so. Lots of the guys have been doing it as well. But anyway, yes, sweatbands on our ankles.
Doesn't it make you quicker, if more streamlined, if you shave your legs?
I think it's more about the look.
I'm thinking more.
I don't think there's a performance element to it. But yeah, I mean, it just runs into your shoes and makes them soaking wet, and then you're at higher risk of getting blisters. It's just heavier to run around. You could add like half a kilo onto your feet with just moisture in there.
Can I say that's genius? Absolute genius. Because
it is. So- and that's the thing. I was thinking, how have we? I've never seen this before.
Never.
I'm sure I've never seen this before,
never.
But it seems so normal.
That's such a good idea because you either have hairy legs, and as you say, largely for the look, they don't want to have the hairy legs, and you'd have to have quite a lot of hair, really.
I mean,
you'd have to be really.
Women would
hairy.
Struggle a bit more to have enough hair to stop the stop the moisture running down.
And that's,
oh dear,
yeah, it's a thought, isn't it? And that's a genius idea because That's brilliant. I can't believe I've never seen it before. I've never noticed it on her before. So I don't know if she's just started doing it, but how good is that? If you're playing in sweaty, humid conditions, it just stops it running into your shoes and you start slipping and sliding all over the place.
Yeah, it was in the first match. She was sort of halfway through. She had already changed her shoes once, and I think she probably didn't have another pair. I mean, you'd normally have a couple of pairs. Anyway, halfway through the match, she was really struggling with the sweat, and then she just popped them on, and I just thought, why not?
Brilliant.
I don't know, but
brilliant.
She just did it as if it was nothing. And as I say, I'm sort of looking around, being like, does anyone else think this is genius?
Brilliant.
I love it.
I said brilliant. I think it's an absolutely brilliant idea. I think more people...
You just have sweatbands all the way up your legs, all the way up, just covered in towel.
Just, if you're a really sweaty person, just... I think I can think of a few players, I not name and shame them, but I probably won't name them, that should just do that, because I think it would make such a difference. I think that the thing is, at this year's Australian Open, we didn't really have those types of temperatures. So there were a handful of days, and on those handful of days, the players struggled because, and I was speaking to a couple of coaches, the players were struggling because they hadn't been practicing in the heat, in that kind of heat, and suddenly you got a day of that kind of heat. I remember Daniil Medvedev saying, well, I'm glad my opponent retired. He said, because I was feeling it. You know, I just wasn't used to it. But we had rain, we had wind. I mean, it was pretty cool in terms of the temperature at the Australian Open.
Yeah, but it's one of the challenges of the Australian Open is dealing with the differences in conditions, and that it changes from practice to practice, from match to match. The day session is wildly different to the evening session in terms of temperatures, because it's such a dry heat, so it can really drop off by a lot in terms of the temperature. It's different with the roof closed to it not being closed. I mean, you can have any sort of season in Melbourne, really. And I mean, all in all, it was quite mild. We did have that hot day thrown in, but I mean, we weren't frying eggs on the court like we have done in previous years.
No, it was quite chilly. It was definitely jumper. I actually had a scarf as well, which is probably quite extreme. But as we know, commentary boxes can be quite cold. So I was definitely kind of packed up to prepare for the weather. Let me ask you, if you won a Grand Slam singles title, what would you do? Would you go straight back to work? Would you celebrate for the rest of the year? Would you have a massive party? What would be your kind of reaction to winning a first Grand Slam singles title?
Oh, I don't know. I think you probably enjoy the evening. You got to do your photo shoot the next day anyway. So I enjoy the evening. I'd probably want to try and get back home, because at that stage, you've been there for a while, right?
Yeah.
I'd probably try and get back home, because at home is where you're going to, you know, that's where you feel the impact of it, the wider impact. You know, you sort of enjoy it yourself, you and your team. And then you go home and all of the sacrifices your family have made and your friends are there and everybody who you know is going to have been screaming at the TV, has been setting their alarm for 2 o'clock in the morning to watch you play, whatever it might be. And then you sort of get to soak all of that in and you feel like an absolute legend, I'm sure.
Sinner is back in Italy, but he's also back in the gym. And I was thinking, if I just won a Grand Slam singles title, not I'd necessarily be partying, because that's not the mindset of someone that goes and wins a Grand Slam title, but I don't think I'd go near a set of weights. I don't think I'd go near a gym for at least a while. Would that be fair? I mean, I don't have the mindset of an athlete, obviously.
Well, it depends, doesn't it? I mean, I think it also depends on which slam you win, because just of how the schedule works. I think Australia is probably the toughest one to really take a significant break after, because you're only just getting started with the season. You've just had 6 weeks off. I mean, Sinner had, 6 weeks because of the Davis Cup, but, you know, 6-7 weeks off. And, you know, I don't know, you sort of, you've done the work, you want to keep it going, you don't want to let anything slip. So you've got that on your mind. If you win Wimbledon, there's sort of a natural little break. You could get away with, you know, a week of really just sort of, you know, taking in the applause, soaking up the adoration, doing some TV bits and bobs before really getting back onto court. Probably difficult this year, though, with the Olympics. Maybe that's actually squeezed a bit because the schedule's tighter. US Open's the one. You could just go bag the rest of the season, everyone. I don't care. I am a Grand Slam champion. It's nearly the end of the year. And I'm going to, we've seen it, haven't we, with with a lot of players that'll just sort of go do the talk shows, and they're here, they're there, they're everywhere, and then, you know, they'll play some tournaments, but, you know, it's fine. I mean, to be fair, Coco Gauff didn't do that last year. She ploughed on, and then probably celebrated in the off season. But I think the US is probably the easiest one to really, you know, sort of let the shoulders drop and go, okay.
The mindset, you know, of a champion, Jannik Sinner, because, you know, the Australian Open has cameras everywhere in all the changing rooms, the gyms, the corridors. And it's like a little bit like Big Brother. We were just sitting in the commentary box and we'd come off air, and I was just looking at all the pictures because they show him walking back through the corridor of champions and wandering around. And it's quite nice actually to watch. But they had cameras in, I think it was the gym or the men's locker room, one of the two. And he was there with his team, and there was a really serious conversation. There were no kind of smiles and I've done it. It was a really serious conversation. And I remember speaking to my colleague Ross, and we were like, gosh, I wonder if something's happened, because it seemed quite sort of angry and quite tense. And it lasted for a few minutes, and the whole team was there. And then afterwards in press, he admitted, Jannik Sinner, that already with his coach Simone, he was talking about what he could have done better and what he needs to work. And I'm thinking, wow, of all the things that would go through my mind that soon after winning my first major, it probably wouldn't be that.
I think that it is for a lot of people, because, you know, you've got the match fresh in your mind, and, you know, you've got that initial celebration, of course, and you've done it. But I just think it's such a natural thing. Every match you play, whether you win or you lose, you're sitting on the bike or whatever you're doing, and you're running through it in your head, you're digesting it with your team. I remember speaking to a former player, a British player who, you know, I mean, had been going, you know, deep in second week of slams for a long time, incredibly successful, and they retired at Wimbledon, and that was their last match, and they were still sat. They just automatically started with the coach breaking down the match and talking about what to work on. And the coach had to say, no, you're literally not going to step on a tennis court again. Well, apart from recreationally. So it's fascinating, isn't it? It's just part of who you are.
Yeah, no, it goes to show I don't have the mindset of a champion or an athlete. And apparently I don't have the mindset of a coach. I have newfound admiration for coaches, because I was a coach, I think, what was it, for a couple of days before I was fired. And
yeah, you weren't up to scratch.
For those that haven't seen on social media, Daniela Hantikova hired me as her coach for the Legends. I was in the box on Margaret Court Arena for a first match with her partner Lee Nall, and they won. I resisted the coaching snacks that are offered in the box. I thought that's very unprofessional. But I missed 7 a.m. practice. Who practices at 7 a.m? I missed 7 a.m. practice the next morning and I was fired. It's brutal. I mean, it's brutal. I can't. I was living on the edge. I wasn't sure. Wonderfully, by the end of the tournament, I think I was rehired. But in terms of my coaching career, I'm out. I mean, you know, I played 1-1-1. And I don't know how you guys do it, because that is a very uncertain lifestyle. And I only had it for like 2 days.
Well, I don't do it. That's how I do it. I don't.
But you coach like little people, and you could have parents coming up to you saying, hang on a second, you've been coaching my little person for 2 months and I don't see them as a future world number one. We're going to find someone else. I mean, it's a tricky, difficult, demanding industry.
The thing is that you have that conversation with such regularity. It is absolutely extraordinary. So you just know exactly what to do. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. And it's amazing how often it happens. And you're just like, really? Having this again, just a smile and move and deal with it and move on. But yes, of course, well, my brother is in that situation now, because since the last pod, although I did heavily imply that's what was happening, without, I wasn't at liberty to 100% confirm, but, you know, hopefully the tennis listeners got the hint when I was saying it looks like, and hopefully they'll get to work together. But anyway, he's working with Emma Raducanu. Tough start, I must say, just being a Grand Slam. Just, you know, they did a couple of weeks of training back in London before Christmas, and then things weren't sorted for him to get to Auckland. So it was just a pier, and it's a Grand Slam, and it's a circus, because it's Emma Raducanu and she is such a superstar. There are thousands of people at every practice session. There's so much, you know, what comes with a Grand Slam, it is not just about the tennis. There's so much else that goes on that goes in. The focus is high. The scrutiny is high. Everybody's sort of losing their minds a bit. And obviously, you know, for Emma, she's desperate to get off to a good start. And I think it was a pretty reasonable start considering she'd been out for such a long time. But yeah, it was a tough first week on the job, I must say, just arrive in Melbourne. And then all of a sudden you're just in the midst of a slam. That's it. But I mean, you know, Nick's fairly used to it. He's been at slams as a coach for a long time.
But this must feel different because she's kind of a superstar. You know, she's
different.
In her short time as a tennis player, because it really is a short term, really, she has already transcended the sport. And people call her Emma rather than Emma Raducanu. They speak to her and she's one name. She's like Prince and all these other people. she is a superstar. And imagine as a coach, when all you want to do is knuckle down and do your bits and pieces for the matches, it must be quite hard, right?
Yeah, and no disrespect to Aliash Bedene, who was the last player my brother was on tour with. But we love Aliash.
Hang on, his wife's a superstar in Slovenia.
Well,
a pop star, isn't she?
When you go to Slovenia, it's a big deal, of course.
Big news.
But
big news.
No, I mean, the global appeal. And I think people possibly underestimate it because it's been obviously, two and a half years now since she won. And there have been lots of ups and downs, a lot of downs really for her in terms of her match results and in terms of physically. But I think, people really do underestimate. I mean, her crowds were huge, some of the biggest. Okay, maybe not as big as Osaka, but right up there. You know, she is such a big superstar. And you're right, she is just Emma. And poor Emma Navarro, if she ever wins a slam, she cannot have just Emma. She's going to have to be Emma Navarro. She's doing well, right? She's in the top 30. She's flying up. She might. You never know.
But she will always be Emma Navarro. It's incredible. But it was good. You talked about the positives from Emma Raducanu, the positives. It looked like, just from an outsider, that she's enjoying her tennis and able to focus on the tennis, and maybe she doesn't feel that weight of expectation that she had in the immediate aftermath when she was playing as a Grand Slam champion.
Yeah, it feels like a big reset, doesn't it? You know, which is great. It was just totally needed. It's sort of, now she's ready to go. But it's amazing to think that she has obviously so much experience, but so little experience. She has experience in terms of playing on big arenas and winning on big arenas. But she doesn't have the experience really on sort of the day-to-day WTA tour events, I suppose. Look, she's played them for the past couple of years, don't get me wrong. But it's a fascinating mix of stuff. I mean, it's just bizarre, right? Because what happened was bizarre. It was bizarrely brilliant, absolutely magical. But it just, how do you wrap your head around it? And everywhere you go, you're treated like a Grand Slam champion, but you feel like a bit of a rookie on the tour. It's just crazy. I don't know how you cope with it, to be honest. I think it has been difficult for her to cope with it, but now it feels like, it's a new chapter, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And we said it at the start of the year, there's so many exciting kind of storylines to look out for this year. And one thing we talked about, and you picked her to defend her title, was Aryna Sabalenka. And God, she looked good. I mean, she looked so comfortable. She looked so good. And you've got to think of how well she played last year after winning Australia. If she can keep up this form, she didn't play Doha last year, so nothing to defend there. Świątek won it. Dubai, Sabalenka got to the quarterfinals. Świątek got to the final. I mean, is this now the Sabalenka era? Can she go on to dominate?
Well, I think a lot of people watching what she produced have been saying that. It's so easy to slip into it, isn't it? But it's just incredibly hard to do, on all the different surfaces and the different conditions and physically and the different preparations and the run-ins. Look, the Australian Open is her favourite tournament by far, right? Yeah. Like, she's very comfortable. She won her first title there. She's defended now. It's hard, which is her best surface. That is her favorite event. So, I did really fancy her chances in defending. She didn't lose a set, and I couldn't really see who was going to trouble her much in the draw. She just sort of flew through, really, didn't she? So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, she's one of the favorites to win everywhere she goes, but you never know with Świątek. And the thing is, with such an aggressive game like Sabalenka has, it's all about finding that balance. and having that control. And the slightest thing can throw you off, whether it's the wind, the speed of the court, the balls don't feel right, bit of altitude, whatever it might be. Some things just really work in your favour, and sometimes you're never going to quite feel right, and then all of a sudden you're just missing instead of just making it, or whatever it might be. So I think it's going to be hard to dominate. But if she plays how she did in Melbourne for the rest of the year, well, then sure, of course, she's probably going to win three slams this year. But I mean, that's just a massive, massive if, isn't it?
I also think it's an obvious thing to say, but your surroundings do play a part. I mean, I love the fun she has with her team. I think that's so important. Yes, you have to get the balance as well, but I like the fact they have fun and they laugh, because there must be so much pressure. I mean, Novak Djokovic has even apologised in the past to his team for the pressure he puts them under and the stress, and which I don't think can be a good thing. I mean, you look at the Djokovic box, they look terrified most of the time. Look, he's still massively successful, still winning, he'll still go on to win. But I like that balance. I think when it comes to the team, that you're going to have fun, relax the player. And I think that's what you're seeing more of if you look in these boxes, like the Sinner box with Darren Cahill. He's a very relaxed character. There seems to be a really good blend. They said, look, we have fun and we're also serious. And I think that's something that's starting to come across, the teams that are put together and that relationship, which helps them when you get into what is a Grand Slam is a very stressful couple of weeks.
It just looks like a team you want to be a part of, doesn't it? It just looks like it's really fun. They've got perspective. Sure, she's going to get angry and frustrated when things aren't going her way, or if she misses a shot or whatever it is. But it feels like there's perspective on there. You don't feel like, you know, even if she were to lose that final, that she would be, you know, yes, she might smash up a racket, as we saw on, where was that? US Open, wasn't it? After that final, she'll smash up a racket. She'll be angry. She'll be frustrated. All of those are, you know, totally relevant. But don't feel like she's going to be moping around, feeling sorry for herself, sort of going, oh, I want to quit, I can't do it. You know, you feel like the belief is there. It's just the frustration that she didn't deliver. Because, you know, look, I think her and her team, the belief is sky high. They know if she just plays the way she can, she beats everyone. I mean, who's going to stop her, really? You know, she can overwhelm Świątek. You know, who is going to be able to match that level? And the truth is that no one really can at the moment. But it is just, if that level wavers, what then could happen? But yeah, they have so much belief in her and so much respect for her. And I think that comes from fighting. You know, the impact that has, if you are a coach on the sideline, if your player bails on a match, it does so much damage for the morale and just for the overall focus and energy of the team. If you're a coach who's been up until 1 o'clock in the morning doing video analysis and you're doing this, you're doing that, and look, you know, the coaches aren't making millions. They're not. You know, of course, yes, if your player's winning a Grand Slam, you're going to be doing very well, having a nice time. Don't get me wrong. But in terms of just your standard tour coach, if you have a player that even occasionally, like once every 3 months, just sort of bails, if they go sort of a set and a breakdown, they just can't quite. It's so hard to have the belief that the player expects from you. And it's hard to have the sort of mutual respect as well, because, you know, if you look at them, they are just, they're there. It doesn't matter what the score is. They know that she is going to be fighting and fighting and fighting to try and work her way back. She's never going to roll over. And that's why she's been so consistent. And one of my favourite stats, is not a common stat that's been thrown out about Sabalenka, but one of my favourite ones, I might have mentioned it on the pod before, is that the last time she lost in a slam in straight sets was the US Open 2020. It is 2024. She's played all of those events. She missed a Wimbledon. She wasn't allowed to play. But, you know, she's always gone down fighting if she's gone down. Every single match loss, and that's 14 slams now, 13 losses because she's won one of them. Oh, no, 12 losses because she's won two of them now. Sorry, I'm getting behind my stats. She's won two of them. Keep up, come on. So out of all 12 of those matches have been three sets, whether she's lost to Świątek or Rybakina, who doesn't, or somebody lower ranked, doesn't matter who it's been, she's always been right there battling away. And like that's why I think you get that energy from them in the yeah. stands, right? It's just such a confidence. They just back her.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Heartbreak for Daniil Medvedev, his third loss in Australian Open final, his second loss from two sets to Love Up. But you feel if there's, you feel if there's a player or a person who will turn that into a positive and change that, it is Medvedev. I think his attitude is great. I know he can sometimes be the villain on the court. He speaks so well in his press conferences, especially this one after the final. But I don't worry for him. I feel like he will be back. I think his attitude, although sometimes on the court he can be really grumpy and kind of just yell towards his box, I think he can take that and turn it around. Because I mean, how heartbreaking must that have been to be two sets up and comfortable in the third set and to lose in five after over 24 hours on court across the 2 weeks?
It was brutal. Absolutely brutal. It was tough to watch, especially when you could feel it turning. He must have been tired. I know he's super wiry and you feel like he never gets tired, but he must have been tired. It was so tough, wasn't it, to watch? I mean, it was great for Sinner, of course. But look, again, Medvedev's got that level of perspective that Sabalenka's got, right? It's... You know, he's going to be frustrated. He's going to be, you know, pissed off after a loss like that. But he just has a perspective on, like, we're just playing tennis here. And ultimately, you're a multimillionaire who's just been in the final of a Grand Slam. Like, things are not that bad. And I think that is what the reason why both of those players, Sabalenka and Medvedev, are now really consistent. Because you can just bounce back. It's not, you know, somebody who is a very bad loser, for example, and I don't necessarily mean it as a criticism. You can totally understand. But somebody like Stefanos Tsitsipas has, you know, the big matches that he's lost, you feel like it's months before he's actually sort of snapping back out of it. Like, it takes a long time, and it always has done. And it's a good thing to an extent, but it makes it, he's just too emotional about it, right? And you have to be able to detach yourself somewhat. You have to be, it's a really odd balance, right? You have to sort of be prepared to put your life on the line and think that it's the most important thing in the world, but also emotionally be able to have that level of perspective. It's very, very difficult to do. I feel like Medvedev does that. You know, you don't think that he's going to be not eating and sleeping after that sort of loss, but sure, it's going to hurt and it's tough to see it.
And something else that's tough, and we talked about this the last, Andrei Rublev, I think we asked the question, is he gonna get through a Grand Slam quarterfinal? And still the answer is no. I'm wondering, as I watch him in a Grand Slam quarterfinal, I've now lost all belief that he's going to win it, which is an awful thing to say. So I wonder about the player himself. Because if he wasn't aware of the stat, every time he goes into a press conference, they tell him about the stat.
Yeah, exactly. So you can't get away from it. If you want to ignore it, you can't. And it really annoys players. It will be asked in every single press conference. But that's how it is. The thing for Rublev, and I mean this with the best of intentions. I know you're a massive fan, as am I. His best way to reach a semi-final is to win a bunch of Masters events and get himself to number four in the world. Because the problem is that he keeps coming up against one of the top four.
Yeah.
Like that, and that's how the draw works. And okay, you can hope that somebody's going to take them out, but it has to be in your section, whichever one of the four you've got. Yeah, and he is ranked number five in the world, so he's very, very close. But it does feel like the gap between five and four is massive, yeah, doesn't it?
Does.
Those four are out on their own. I mean, that's number four is Sinner. Like, the gap is, you know, Rublev is the best of the rest, but it's so tough to get that breakthrough because he is relying on one of the top four having a bad-ish day. Not a terrible day. You know, Rublev's a quality of, he's world class, he's world number five, but a bad-ish day for the best of five. or he's relying on somebody else to beat them. Now, those things can happen. If he just keeps plugging away, it might happen for him. He might get there. But if he could go and win Indian Wells and win another Masters and win in Rome or win Monte Carlo again or whatever he might do, if he could pick up three Masters events, I mean, he's still not going to be world number four because the gap with the points is quite large. But if he could, you see what I'm saying? If he could pick up those points, if he could somehow, I don't know how it's possible, maybe Sinner doesn't win another match for 6 months, I don't know, but if he could get to world number four, then he'll be playing somebody ranked lower than him in the quarterfinals, and then he's going to do it.
Oh, wow. I love that. That could be his only route to success and to a Grand Slam semi-final. Just blitz everything. Hope people don't. Get to number four. And then the pressure is on because this is your moment. But it was, yeah, it was sad.
Or you've got to sit back and wait and hope. And hope that it happens, right? That's your other option.
So overall, your thoughts on the Australian Open. Was there one person, one thing that stood out? Thought it was a good tournament overall? Where do you sit with it now it's done?
I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was really, really good. The first week, I think, was hard because we had a lot of wind, we had a lot of rain. So weren't necessarily seeing some of the best tennis. But then everything sort of settled itself down. And it was, I thought it was fantastic. And just, I mean, to be honest, utterly dominant performances from Sinner and Sabalenka. I know Sinner was up against it in the final. Obviously, came back from two sets down and Medvedev was great. But really... they were the best players comfortably.
And good to see some of the younger players coming through and showing that kind of I have no fear attitude, I can do this. And a lot of people talking about it's the Emma Raducanu effect because they've seen someone who's come through qualifying and done the extraordinary. And not saying they're all going to go and do that, but they've got the belief that there is a chance. Because before it was like, well, there's no chance you could do that. That doesn't happen. Maybe it's a one-off. Maybe it'll never, ever, ever happen again. But the players now think, hang on a second, I could go out there and I could get lucky and I could go on a run. And now we're seeing that. I love the way we see these young players that aren't scared of anyone. They just smack that ball. They get out there. Noskova, I hadn't seen an awful lot, so it's really nice to see more of Noskova. Ondrejva makes me laugh because she's feisty. She seems to have it all and she seems to be here to stay. We had Maria Timofeva, the qualifier, came through and was just crunching the ball and dispatching anybody in her way. I thought it was really nice to see those younger players get some big wins on the big stage.
Yeah, they really are feisty and that belief is strong. I mean, what, Yastremska made the semis all the way from qualifying. I mean, we've always said that qualifiers tend to do really well in tournaments, you know, getting to the third round, maybe last 16, that's sort of what you think in your head. But yeah, I mean, Emma's blown it wide open with that sort of result. I think everybody in the tournament thinks it's possible, which is great. I think it's such an added element. Like, we never used to be like that. You get some wild results. But yeah, really enjoying the youngsters. It's sort of back to that because we had a period of time where we sort of lost all the teenagers. There was a period of time where there were no teenagers in the top 100 on the women's side, which is like the first time in history.
Yeah.
I remember there was a time when there was one, and I remember it was Donna Vekic. She was the only teenager when she was like 19. And then now they're back. They're back with a force.
Now, something else I just wanted to touch on because it's been in the media the last couple of days is Andy Murray suffered a defeat to Benoit Paire in three sets in Montpellier. An article was written sort of saying, is he going to do damage to his legacy if he continues? Andy Murray actually was tagged in it and actually replied to it saying, hang on a second, I know things aren't good, but, you know, look at what I've done and I'm different to others. I think something we've always said is, yes, it has become difficult in recent times seeing some of these matches when he hasn't won, but it's no one's position or right to tell him what he should do with his career and when he should end it because of everything he's achieved. And you know what? Even if he hadn't achieved all those things, it's still no one's right or position to say that when someone should stop doing something that they quite obviously love.
Yeah, it's his life, right? I mean, it's just up to him what he wants to do with it. It's totally ridiculous. If you don't want to watch him anymore, don't watch him. It's not hard.
And it's not going to tarnish the legacy because you cannot take away everything that he's done and everything that he's achieved. And I think what it does show, I suppose we're all kind of scratching our heads wondering when it will happen, just because we're curious as to when it might happen. But I think one thing that stands out about him is he just loves it. He loves playing. Right, he's done it for years. He still gets the joy out of it. Yes, he said he knows this is a really bad period for himself, but he loves being out there playing. So I feel sorry for him because he's going to be asked the question, how are you feeling? When's it going to stop? And it's completely, I know why some people ask the question, but at the same time, it must be really tough for him because he just wants to get out there and play and turn it around.
Yeah, I think one of the most difficult things for him to swallow and reading that exchange that they had on Twitter was he knows he can play better than this right now, not sort of longing for yesteryear or anything like that. He knows he can produce better than he is producing right now. And, you know, we have seen it. I mean, I remember the back end of last season, we were talking about it because I did quite a few of his matches and he was so close to picking, like when he nearly beat De Minaur twice when he had match points. But the level he produced there was a top 20 level for the whole match. And okay, he lost both of those. But, you know, the level for him to be winning matches in slams is absolutely there. And for him to be doing better than he is, it's there. And I think that's the hardest thing for him. Is that he knows he can just be playing better than this. He doesn't think he can win the Australian Open, but he knows he can win matches there. Like he knows he's capable of it, but there's some sort of mental block. It's not happening. It's just he's not allowing himself or whatever it is. I'm sure he's desperately trying to figure it out, but he's not going to kid himself. He knows with the training he's been doing and with some of the performances he's put in, his level is there. It's just he's just not getting the results.
And that's the hard thing on this kind of stage. Everything is so public. We've talked about this with players before. When Sabalenka was double faulting, it felt like every point she had to play that out in public. You know, there's nowhere to hide. If you're going to regain your form, if you've worked on something or you're rebuilding something, it's played out in public because they are the match situations that people are watching. And I think that's always been the admirable thing of those players who can work their way through being on a very public stage. If stuff's going on off the court that people don't know about, you're still having to come on the court and then people make judgments because you're not playing well. I know you kind of put yourself in this position and you know that's what's going to happen, but I do find that very tough that everything is played out and is so public.
Yeah, I don't know. I just find, I don't know why people think they sort of have the right to dictate things or say, you know, it's not about you. It's just not about you. And he's had millions of people watching him throughout his entire career. You as one person thinking that he should call it a day, no one cares. Venus is still playing. Go on, Venus.
There you go. And I think people have stopped asking her when she's going to stop playing.
Yeah, but does that tarnish her legacy because she's losing first round in events? Of course not.
No, that she is and will always be as good as she was. Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? But I just wanted to touch on that because that's been rumbling around this week when it came up. In terms of the tennis, it doesn't stop, does it? I think you rightly said after Australia, there's no really slowing down time. People are off. There's Davis Cup qualifiers this weekend and the tournaments continue. And then I'm off to Doha a week on Saturday for an event there. It's just, there is no time to pause now. But I was thinking about this. For the next three Grand Slams, we are going to be on the same time zone. That's exciting news.
Yes.
Yeah. All three now. Same time zone.
Maybe it'll work out for a pod. Who knows?
Well, as we know, a lot of other things have got to fall into place. But we made this one work. And we're going to make... The best time it works is when all the children are at school, nursery. I was about to say college, but we're not quite there yet, are we? at school or nursery, then we can get it done. So all being well, in a week's time, we're going to be back and we're going to be talking more tennis.
Yeah, exactly. Can't wait.
I'll speak to you soon.
Season rolls on.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.